When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
There was a light on the seafront outside, shining straight up into the room. And in the glow reflected from the ceiling, she looked down at the sleeping boy. He was frowning and his face glistened with sweat. He was strong and stocky, not as formed as a grown man, of course, because he wasn't much older than she was. But he'd be powerful one day. How much easier if his demon had been visible. She wondered what its form might be and whether it was fixed yet. Whatever its form was, it would express a nature that was savage and courteous and unhappy.
Hello and welcome to this podcast where we run through the BBC HBO show His Dark Materials, episode by episode. My name is Helen O'Hara and I'm here with my co-host Dave Corkery.
Hello, Helen. How are you?
Hello. I'm very well, thank you. I'm glad to be back for a second season. Look at us.
I know. Yeah, here we are. Season two. The subtle
Who would have thought?
Knife, right?
The subtle knife. Yeah, basically. Well, we'll get into exactly what they're covering this season, I think, in a little bit. But before we go any further, we should warn listeners, this is, of course, a spoiler podcast. We will be discussing everything in the show and the books up to this point. We will not go beyond this. We will not look too far ahead. If you're reading the book with the show, we will not spoil what's coming, although we may vaguely allude to things sometimes, but we'll try and keep it very spoiler-free. But if you have not seen season one and season two, episode one of His Dark Materials, then please go away, watch those, and do rejoin us afterwards.
What are you doing here? Do you not know how TV works? We've clearly
been a horrific
labeled
misunderstanding.
And also, we have our whole first season of podcast to accompany you on your first season journey. You, the people who seem to have stumbled in here without having watched season one, including a range of interviews with Ruth Wilson, Daphne Keane, a lot of the cast and crew. So we had a lot of fun. And it is just me and Helen today, but we do have some really cracking guests lined
good.
Up.
Yeah.
Don't want to spoil anything right now, but just stick with us.
Yes, we'll spoil some things. We'll spoil the episode, but we don't want to spoil that. But yes,
yeah.
Very exciting guests coming up. If you want to get in touch with us, if you have any questions for future episodes or any comments on this episode, of course, you can get in touch on Instagram. We are at Stripped Media. Twitter, it's at Stripped Media UK. And you can use the His Darker Materials hashtag when telling us what that is. So, first of all, what did you think of this episode? Was it an exciting start to the season?
Yeah, I thought so. Well, I think there's not a whole lot of action. Actually, there is quite a bit in the middle, to be fair. But it felt to me like a lot of setup and place setting, which is okay. But for me, the big thing was the meeting of Lyra and Will at last, right? And Daphne Keane and Emir Wilson just have the best chemistry, I thought.
They do. It felt like something clicking into place immediately, didn't it? It just felt like, oh, this seems right. This is good, yeah.
Yeah, and it kind of felt like they had already met. Like, it was almost a revelation to me that these two characters were meeting each other because we spent so much time with them in season one. And I guess, you know, having read the books, you feel like you know them so well. So that, that's a nice way to put it. They do sort of just like they fit together perfectly. Mm. But the two of them, as actors, they're really nailing the sort of chalk and cheese element a bit, which I liked. And like that, they're quite interesting in the way that they approach things, like their different approaches to things, like omelets.
Well, exactly. Yes, which I thought was actually it's a really good scene. I feel like sometimes cooking scenes, I feel like it's been done in maybe I'm thinking of The Odd Couple, but cooking scenes can be quite a good way to get to know somebody in a strange sense. And I think, and just through the medium of discussing eggs, which is a thing that's taken from the book, you know, it does happen when they meet for the first time. But it's kind of expanded upon and drawn out a little bit more here. And I think it works really well to just show you Lyra's kind of unthinking sort of poshness, actually. And yeah. The way that she's been a little bit coddled in an odd way. I know she's been through like hell. We've all been there. We've seen it with her in season one. But, you know, her life is one where other people do the cooking for her. Thanks very much.
Yeah. And they have Roger the kitchen boy.
Roger's the kitchen boy. Yeah. And so, oh, this must be another kitchen boy, this Will guy, because, you know, here he is knowing how to make an omelette, which is kind of interesting. And I'll be honest, like, Oxford is a bit like that, even for students. Like, you know, you do have a person who literally comes and empties your bin and will clean your room weekly if you let them in and aren't asleep every single time they come by.
Quick reminder that Helen went to Oxford.
Sorry, I didn't mean it that way. I do think it's worth saying, like, it is a weird little enclosed world. This is why politicians who come out of Oxbridge are sometimes terrible people, because they've gone from public school to this enclosed, cloistered world where everything is done for them, and then they go into like the bar or something, which is kind of the same, and then, you know, bad things happen to the country. But that's a wider point. The point is,
also, you don't want this government making you an omelette. let's just put that out there.
That's a very good point. I think it would turn out like Lyra's. I'm afraid so.
Actually, the whole thing is a great analogy for the last year. the way she drops the eggs on the floor and then just like, instead of cleaning them up, just kind of swishes them around with her foot. Satire.
2020, man. 2020. I just think the scenes between these two are great. And I think it was a super smart decision, actually, to introduce Will last season. Because if you remember when you first read the book, that first chapter where suddenly Lyra is nowhere to be seen and we're in a recognizable world and there's this Will dude, it was quite jarring when I first read the book. I'm like, who's this dude? And where's Lyra gone? And why are there no polar bears?
But it was also, I agree, but it was also like a jaw-dropping moment, because it's like, you know, page one, like you say, you're like, who's this? Who's Will? Where am I? And it's like, but you also have this sense of ground being grounded, because it's our world and it's familiar. And that was also quite exciting, because it was like, oh my God, like Lyra's world is just around the corner from ours. Like, it suddenly just brought the whole thing quite close. And I do feel like that's been a bit lost in this, that sort of wow moment, although arguably we did get that in season one when we all freaked out.
Yeah, and actually,
it was like,
remember,
Will's there.
We were looking on Twitter last year, people were all like, what just happened? Who's this guy? People who hadn't read the book had no idea. So I think that moment still happened, but just a bit earlier. But you're right, it gives us, I think, a bit more of a, not divided loyalty, but a shared loyalty between them. So if when they both come in, you're like, oh, my two heroes are meeting now. Oh, this is good. Yay. And there's none of that kind of heavy lifting of explaining Will at this point. And because it would have had to have been, like, it was spread over a few episodes last time, but it would have had to have been pretty much one solid episode of just Amir and no Daphne, pretty much, to get that much storytelling across and give us the same grinding with the character, I feel like. So, you know. Well, this episode is mostly
omelette scenes.
Character scenes.
We're going to have a whole cooking episode now.
I guess reorienting ourselves scenes and kind of not just things happening and pieces moving into place, but also kind of people reacting to the seismic, literally seismic change at the end of last season, with that massive door opening between worlds and everything shifting as a result. And everybody's having to kind of reckon with that, I feel like, in this episode.
Yeah, maybe that's a good point to just jump into the Magisterium for a minute and Lyra's world and where we kind of where things pick up with Mrs. Coulter and Father MacPhail and crew, because you're right, there has been, I think seismic is a good word good way to put it. There's a giant Marvel villain plot device, blue beam in the sky, right? And the Magisterium's instinct, as we hear from the Cardinal, who seems to be in charge, is very much like, don't worry, nothing to see here. Like Leslie Nielsen in Naked Gun with the fireworks happening behind it. Don't worry about it. No, nothing in the sky. Carry on. And Mrs. Coulter, as pragmatic as ever, is very much like she's leaning into this thing. No, let's, like, this is real. It's out there. Come on, let's go explore. And that's kind of her hunger and curiosity needs to be sated.
Even though she turned on the chance to actually go through last season in that moment of motherliness, which I think we've seen moments of that from her, but that moment of, if my child is here, I'm staying in this world. And of course her child promptly leaves this world, but you know, she didn't know that at the time. But yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, the differing attitudes. So you've got the Cardinal literally refusing to go on deck and even see the thing because he refuses to believe it exists, therefore he won't look at it. And on the other hand, Father MacPhail, who's like, it exists, shit, now we have to deal with it. What do we do now?
For me, not to go too deep into religion and
let's
all that,
do
right?
it.
But this all right, buckle in, strap in. Yeah. So for me, this kind of idea represents, you know, a religion that is potentially branching off, right? So if you look at the history of Christianity and you know, you've got the sort of Catholicism and then it splits off into Lutheranism and Protestantism and Baptist church or whatever, you know, all the different strands. And this kind of feels like that to me. This feels like you've got one part of an institution which is refusing to adapt, or, you know, say like sex before marriage is wrong. And then you've another part of the institution which is kind of trying to seeing the world around it and adapting and trying to modernize. And that's kind of what we're seeing from Father MacPhail, except with more murder and bloodshed.
Yes, it's like he acknowledges it's happening and wants to shoot whoever's responsible and or blow it up, essentially.
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, which is at least some way of reckoning with the reality of it. You're right, yeah. I mean, the Magisterium is interesting as well. I'm not, again, not going to get into spoilers, but I've been reading the second book of the follow-up series at the moment, The Secret Commonwealth, and there's some interesting stuff in that about the Magisterium itself and the fact that while there is the Magisterium, there is no equivalent of the Pope. There isn't, you know, if it is an equivalent of the Catholic Church, there isn't one single figure who is infallible at the heart of it. It's a sort of a network of different bodies with different purposes that all have slightly different roles. And it's interesting that it appears a monolith from the outside, but perhaps there's a little bit more division inside. And we see a little bit of a hint of that here in this sort of difference of opinion between these two priests, these two clerics, and the sort of a little bit of a power struggle almost between them, which, you know, Father MacPhail backs down because the other dude's a cardinal. But you can see the seeds of something being sown there, I think.
Yeah, exactly. And what's interesting is then you've got Mrs. Coulter always in the middle of the power struggle, kind of playing both sides. Because in this first introductory scene, she knows how to work this cardinal, right? She's like, here's a glass of wine, Mr. Cardinal, sir. And like very, you know, she's, while also taking Father MacPhail away and, you know, and at the end of the episode, it's like, you know, here's what we need to do. She's positioning him and bringing him along for the ride. And I love that line at the end when she says, I will make it my sin. You know, she's almost like he's unwilling to go as far. You know, he's like, call the doctor, call the medic.
Yeah, it's a little bit like, I mean, does he, though, really need medical attention? I think her position's really interesting because we know a little bit from season one that she's been through the mill. And that she suffered disgrace in her past. And she has built her way back up from that to this position of, you know, power and responsibility within the church, which is kind of no mean feat. And it's really interesting to me how much she can do with that background in this society, you know, and that she's been able to get over to that to the extent that she has been. And I think it's because no one really knows how she feels about Lyra. Maybe to some extent she doesn't either, but there's a real kind of disconnect in her professional life, I guess, and sort of motherhood. It seems wrong to use that word about her even so, but, you know, there are moments.
I know, it's wrong. It's like in season one, every time she was motherly, it felt like a wrong and alien. And that's what, to Ruth Wilson's strength, she played that weird conflict so perfectly. But I think that's the way you put it is good, that sort of that disgrace almost powering her ambition. Like, would she have even got this far without that sort of drive of overcoming that shame? Because that probably resulted in her, you know, sacrificing a personal life for that, because she's quite ashamed by herself as well, and that's what we see in her demon it's a real repression which she's funneled into this just unstoppable meteoric rise to the top, right?
Yeah, and I think it may also be what causes people to underestimate her or to think that she can be useful to them only to a point, like they can use her and then get rid of her past a certain point. Because that line you pointed out about, I will make it my sin, you know, he feels like that's a thing that, first of all, that she is capable of doing. She could kind of murder or at least allow this dude to die. But second of all, that's a viable opportunity for him, and it's not going to rebound on him, and it's not going to come back to bite him, because she is in some sense maybe controllable or has, you know, some kind of weakness in her past, maybe. And that's why, I don't know, maybe there's an element of underestimating her. Maybe I'm wrong, but...
No, you're right, you're right. He doesn't feel... We never get a sense from MacPhail that he's threatened by her as such. Yeah, he feels, like, comfortable. It's almost like she's taken something away from him, but he's comfortable. Yeah, as you say, it's not going to come back on him. But she's somebody who's comfortable with doing extreme things, and... We see that in this episode to in this quite horrifying, I thought, torture scene.
Yeah, right? It's real. I mean, without being graphic at all, it's pretty hardcore, because, you know, she's pulling, okay, what are basically branches of cloud pine out of the witch's skin. And I thought that was a great sort of twist on the mythology. You know, in the books, it talks about them using cloud pine to fly, but there are literally, and I watched out for this on a reread after I watched this episode, they literally talk about grabbing their branches and flying. So it is more like a broom, you know, it's not like it's embedded in their skin. This is something that the TV show has added. And first of all, it's a really beautiful idea, the way it's kind of carried out and the way it's sort of shown on her skin. But second of all, of course, it makes it terrifying when she starts kind of pulling it out. It's like pulling out, you know, fingernails or something. It's horrifying.
Yeah. I was quite upset by it. Like, I was just like cringing. Like, the desired effect really hit me. Mm. And again, I came back to that thing of like, it's like, is this suitable for kids? I know we talked about this last season, but it's pretty hardcore. Mm. And I think I think to its credit, sews the book. Like, the book doesn't really shy away from tricky subject matters. But seeing something like that brought to life, like, it's very much a torture scene, and it's very scary. I thought, like, Ruth Wilson in this is a scary presence. Mm. And she's doing all the classic torturer things that we've seen in fiction, you know, where you slowly take off your jewelry and place it, and
you've got the tray of sinister looking instruments all neatly laid out.
Yeah. Ooh. All the tropes.
All of the tropes. But also this idea that that Lyra has another name, and she's desperate to know what that is. Like, there's real it is desperation there. I'm just going to repeat myself. She has to know. It's like a hunger.
The way she says it as well is this, like, it's almost like a breath. It's like this like release of just anger and fury. It was like a really, like, again, scary. She was almost otherworldly in this scene, I thought, Mrs. Coulter. Really scary. And then the rescue happens from the absolute badass Queen Ruta
Scaddy. Yeah.
Yeah. Played by Jade Anuka, who absolutely smashed it in this episode. I thought she comes into that council meeting where we see Lee Scoresby again, and the witches. This is a lot of like sort of exposition, really, isn't it? And plot setup, but it's like, you will go to Stanislaus Grumman,
and we will go this way.
Exactly. It felt like that's very like Council of Elrond and all this kind of stuff. But I like that stuff. That's when we're back in familiar fantasy land.
Yeah.
And it was interesting to sort of see that contrast with where Will and Lyra are in this
Shittagat.
I don't know why I did it, in honor of Sean Connery. So Queen Ruta comes in, and it was interesting to see sort of the conflict between her and Serafina Pecola, right? This sort of inner witch strife.
Yeah, because so in the book, it is Serafina who goes to the rescue, and here they make it Ruta Skadi, and it is a very interesting change, because I feel like it sets up those two characters in an interesting way. I think, look, it was great in the book that Serafina did it, because I think it's a moment of real, it's both a moment of badassery from her in the book. Like, it's a very, very cool scene. But it's also a moment where it shows her compassion and her fears. Like, she sneaks in and listens to some of the Magisterium Council in the book as well, and gets really worried for her sisters and her sort of invisibility cloak, essentially, that she's essentially in at the time, almost breaks down as a result, because she gets really agitated and she has to kind of keep
I hate when that happens.
I know, right? And she has to get really, really calm in order to kind of resume her invisibility and sneak through the ship and you know, rescue her sister. And so what they've kind of done away with that little bit of spying and that little bit of insight into the Magisterium in favor of a much more frontal attack, really, from Ruta Skadi. And so that's quite effective in, because I think we already know that Serafina cares about her people. We already know that she fears the Magisterium. We already know those things. So maybe it's more useful at this point to have Ruta Skadi kind of establish herself as the more kind of hardcore badass witch of the two of them, because, you know, you have to wonder if there will be conflict there in the future. So Lee Scoresby, though, he's told to go off in search of this Stanislaus Grumman, who we think is dead and beheaded, judging by season one. But maybe he isn't. And therefore, maybe he has a thing that is a magic talisman of some sort that can somehow help Lyra in some fashion. I'll be honest, it seems like a bit of a wild goose chase. And the only goose around here is Serafina Pecola's demon.
Oh,
and it doesn't seem that wild, so...
You had that written down, Helen, right?
Hey, look,
and
no
you've
hands.
Been rehearsing that all day. yeah, it's hard to talk about this without, like, spoiling things. I'm finding, like, my... my knowledge of the book future, which I love to lord up over people who haven't read it, is bearing heavily on me now.
Well,
so I don't have much to add.
Let's just say this. I feel like Lee Scoresby is, first of all, very aware of his luck in being in a council of witches, and very aware of the precarity of his situation being in a council of witches. So fair play to him for presumably getting out the other side okay. And yeah, I guess we'll have to see if his journey pays off. Who knows? We'll see.
We'll just have to wait and see. We definitely shouldn't be writing the coming up next week on
we definitely
the Starker material. Well, let's hop over back to Shatagaja.
I thought this was interesting.
What's going on, Helen?
First of all, she doesn't go straight to the city. She's like wandering around the hills for days, really, before she kind of gets there. It takes her a little while to find it, which is kind of interesting, given you can see it through the rift in the sky of the, you know, Aurora Borealis and such. But yeah, it's cool.
Maybe it's like the side view mirror of a car. You know, objects may appear further away than in reality.
They really are, yes, in the Aurora. But no, it's gorgeous. It's a sort of Mont Saint-Michel, if it was Italian, you know. I feel like I'm actually missing an actual city in Italy that it looks very like, and it's gone on.
Where did they film? Do you know where they filmed?
Yeah, they filmed in Cardiff.
That's in Cardiff?
That's in Cardiff. I was thinking maybe it's like Dubrovnik again, or, you know, they went to Malta or somewhere.
Yeah, Malta vibes.
Cardiff, that's a studio set. It is very well used. When I read that and went back and watched it again, you can see that they've redressed some streets and used some different camera angles and things. But again, their use of special effects and visual effects and sort of tying those two up is really, really impressive there. I think it's done really well.
Yeah, that looked like a real world location to me, like hands down. Very impressive. Although there was one point where I was like, you know, the steps that the two are sitting on.
Yeah.
And there's this beautiful, like, that's a beautiful location. And there's a real symmetry to the way they shot it. With the two of them sitting on either sides, which, like, really, you know, felt like a callback to the opening credits and the whole theme of parallel worlds and all this, which I loved. And I was just like, that can't be a real... Either some badass location scout, like the best location scouts in the world, or they built this.
Is based on a real location, I think. So there's step wells in India, as in wells that have steps in them, not like, I don't know what else it would be, but there's step wells in India that have that sort of interlocking effect. It's used in, if you've seen the film The Fall by Tarsem Singh, where he basically, I think they took like 2 years to film it, and they went all over the world, and it's filmed in the most incredible real world locations. I mean, that film is stunning. I have it on Blu-ray. Huge recommendations. But like, they go to the Blue City in Jodhpur, and they go to the Tivoli outside Rome, and they go to like the desert and I think Namibia. I mean, it's incredible. But they have one of those step wells in that, and they are gorgeous. So anyway, so I think that's where they got the idea.
Okay.
But it works. You're right. I hadn't even thought of the comparison to the opening credits, and of course, it's perfect for that. And it's where Will's portrayed in that, so... Yeah, it works. Although, of course, steps are also where he became a murderer when his cat tripped that dude, fell down the stairs and killed him.
Oh, yeah. So maybe he's got some deep PTSD when it comes to steps.
When it comes to stairs. Oh, God.
And I mean that in both the things that you go up and down, but also the band. it's a real tragedy.
It is a tragedy when the feeling's gone and you can't go on.
The other things that struck me in terms of like little character things, I thought the writing, Jack Thorne wrote this episode, didn't he? And the sort of little character moments that we talked about earlier, so the omelet scene and all these little things that we said, you know, they've got room to expand upon. You get a lot of that with Will and Lyra. You know, you get him, she knocks over a box of lemons and then he, like, carelessly, and then he starts one by one picking them up. Like, he just can't help being this helper. This, you know, he's a carer, and the you know, he saves a bloody cat in this episode. I mean, if you don't, that's virtue signaling if ever I've seen it. Oh God, how cute was it though when he delivers a towel and some soap for Lyra up in the bedroom? Like, my heart melted.
Oh, and explaining what a shower is, I just thought it's a bath standing up. I just thought it was great. But it all goes to this, you know, a guy who's spent his entire life looking out for someone who sometimes can't look out for themselves. And so it makes sense for his personality, and it makes sense from, you know, and reminds us of where he came from and everything. But it's also a great contrast, like you say, to Lyra and her complete disregard for anything other than what is in front of her right this second, right now. We're going and doing the thing right now. Nothing else matters.
Yeah, exactly.
And before it was rescuing Roger, and now it's finding dust.
Yeah, she's really like woman on a mission. With the dust, and she gets that, you know, and that's how we sort of end this episode, isn't it? She gets that purpose again, the excitement, because really for most of this episode, Lyra is moping. You know, moping feels like an unfair way to describe somebody who's seen their friend murdered, but she's not in a good way. You know, she's isolating herself from Will, who at the beginning, who's trying his best to reach out. And it's interesting that only you know, Pan, who is the representation of her deepest inner desires and thoughts, is the one who's saying, you know, the small voice inside her is just like, no, listen to this guy. But everything else about Lyra is saying, go away, yeah. go away. You know, I want to be alone. But she's also afraid to be hurt again, right? I don't think she's
afraid
of friendship.
You know, yeah. afraid to accidentally betray another friend, I think.
Of course, yeah, because she that's the thing. She's got this deep guilt expressed in this episode. You know, I should never have, you know, brought Roger, and it's an incredible feeling. So then when we get to that moment, yeah, where Will mentions his Oxford, and they have this sort of fun dialogue where they realize that how much their worlds have in common. And she gets excited again about the scholars and figuring out Dust. And that's when it's like, we've got Lyra back, you know, that curiosity and that drive that her mother has as well.
Exactly. And I think it was finding out that uncommon language, I guess, when they discover the, you know, electricity, amber, ambaric, electron, you know, that kind of parallel, I thought was just beautifully played by both of them. And again, just showing that sort of, they're coming at things from different directions, but they can meet in the middle sort of moment. Yeah. And I thought that was beautifully played and beautifully written as well. I thought it was really nice. It's in the book, but it was really, really well played on screen.
I'm actually getting more excited talking about it than I was watching it, if that makes sense.
It does. But I think this is, you're right, this is a very much a setup episode. It's kind of reminding us who everybody is, what they care about, what they're trying to do this season to at least some degree. I think the witches haven't quite figured that out yet. Even after their council, they don't quite know how they're going to react to all of this yet. But it's clear that they're going to do something and try and figure that out. You know, Lee isn't quite sure what he's looking for yet, but he knows he's trying to help Lyra, and he knows he's going to keep doing that. And so it's, and then Will and Lyra, by the end of the episode, at least have figured out, okay, whatever we're doing, we're going to work together for a little bit and try and get somewhere with it. So that's all good. Although there is a bit of a maybe cliffhanger of an ending to this one.
A bit. That's a massive old cliffhanger. There's a giant ghoulish specter hanging right behind him, isn't there?
There is. And that's not encouraging, given that everything we know about specters.
Yes, which we hear from the two girls earlier. So let's list off what we do know. Mm. Again, no spoilers from the book. But in this episode, we find out the adults have been, if you're a child, you're unaffected by the specters. The mm-hmm. adults seem to have been sort of hollowed out by them. And we see an example of one which Lyra incredibly bravely walks up to, and sort of, and there's a tenderness to it, the way she walked up to that man as well and stopped him pouring the water. And we know that the town is sort of deserted because of this. But yeah, we finish on this glimpse of what the specters actually look like. And there was a sort of a, I had to describe it, almost this floaty, incorporeal sort of
It's like the ghost of a Dementor, yeah. Isn't it? Really?
Yeah.
I mean, I hate to bring it back to Harry Potter, but like they did a lot of these kind of floating apparition-y things, you know, so that's kind of, yeah, it was less of a Dementor than a Dementor is, but a bit more of a Dementor than you'd be comfortable with. If that
like
makes
a Dementor
sense.
without a head and a hood.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah. I think it's a similar idea, I guess, in coming to think of that. You know, this idea of being hollowed out by it. But also in this world, it seems to have parallels, at least, I think, to what was happening in Bolvangar. It clearly has parallels to this idea of you being separated from your soul, of you being separated from yourself. Of course, of the devastating effects that can have, as we saw with Roger. And the, let's be honest, still devastating effects that it can have, even if done, quote unquote, safely. I mean, we saw even with somebody like Morfydd Clark's nurse, if you remember her, just tiny little role, but she'd been sort of severed in some fashion. We don't quite know exactly what she went through, but we know it was something. And we know that, like, basically a lot of what should have been there in her wasn't there. And I think there's a sense, or at least I took a sense, that the specters were doing something similar in some fashion.
Yeah, good shout. Yeah, it's a very, very, very reminiscent of that. This sort of dead behind the eyes vibe.
Not nice.
It's kind of how I feel after having two kids.
It's just the sleep deprivation. It's fine. His Darker Materials is a Stripped Media production. Our executive producers are Kobe Omanaka and Tom Wally. The episode was edited, mixed, and sound designed by Tom Wally. This episode was produced by Helen O'Hara and Dave Corkery. All our music was composed by John Dix. Our artwork was created by Sam Gilby. And the excerpt read at the top of the show was taken from the book The Subtle Knife by Philip Pullman and published by Scholastic. This episode was recorded remotely in parallel worlds. Finally, big thank you to James Carroll and the team at Northbank Talent Management.
You just heard a Stripped Media production.
If you're listening to this podcast, you must recognize the value of asking questions. At Aramco, our questions help us engineer a better future. How can today's resources fuel our shared tomorrow? How can we deliver energy to a world that can't stop? How can we deliver one of the fuels of the future? How can we sow curiosity to harvest ingenuity? To learn more about how innovation drives us forward, visit aramco.com/poweredbyhow.